Islam forbade painting. Well, Christianity did too. In fact, any monotheistic religion did so. It was not plants and animals that haunted the founders, but the trouble was the man. Painting a man or woman with likeness risked the possibility of birth of another god. A threat of competition against God or Allah was not particularly welcome. But what to do? There was this goddamned ego on the way, and hence evolved the entire body of Mughal art. Mughal art is not native Indian art. Welcome to my podcast, Art Beyond Canvas. If you like my podcast, please press the bell icon and follow me. Let us begin from how it all started. As I mentioned in the previous episode, right after 90 years of the foundation of Islam by Muhammad, Islamic invaders knocked the door of Hind. But the early invaders and hence the sultans were not really patrons of art, but they remained busy in replacing temples and Buddhist monasteries with mosques. They were too busy for art and artists. At that time, the Indian artists were catering to the merchants who were mostly Jains. The art form that prevailed was mostly the depiction of Tirthankara's life in native Indian style. It was around late 15th century that Ghiyasuddin Khalji ascended the throne of Malwa as the Sultan. As soon as he came to power, he announced that he was tired of the warfare. He would henceforth devote himself to religious affairs and cultures, when his son would take care of the affair of battle and so on. But what he meant by culture was slightly counterintuitive in today's perspective. He focused on expanding his harem. The legend says that he managed to accumulate more than 15,000 women in his harem. Well, I would rather explain this matter, though it is not directly connected to the story of art that I am narrating in this podcast. These 15,000 women were not mere objects of desire for the Sultan. Each woman in the harem was trained extensively in something or the other based on their aptitude. And such trainings were to bring their skill to a professional level. He did not only employ such women as his personal bodyguards, but also his court consisted of women at all important and powerful positions. It is an unprecedented level of woman empowerment drive launched by the Sultan of 15th century. Ghiyasuddin Khalji was a food aficionado too, and he was a patron of art. He commissioned a book about cookery named Nimat Nama. It described the recipes of various delicious dishes. The recipes were often accompanied by paintings where the Sultan was being treated with samosa or sharbat. But ironically, in the entire book, only man who figures is the Sultan himself. Rest of the characters painted are all women. Nimat Nama is important because it was the first flash of art in India after Islam began to grow its root in the subcontinent. But frankly speaking, it is rather counterintuitive how the particular style came to existence in the book, because it is evident that the style was not entirely Indian. Neither was it close to Persian. Of course, we find the mixing of one basic feature that was different in Persian art and native Indian style. It was a way of drawing a human face. Native Indian style was to paint the face in profile all the time, whereas the Persian way was to paint the face in three-quarter view. In the paintings of Nimat Nama, we often find one character with profile view and the other with three-quarter view. The painting that illustrated the making of samosas is a perfect example of such blending of styles. There are three women with faces in three-quarter, quite looking like Persian faces in Persian art influenced by actually Chinese art of the time, whereas there are four women painted with face depicted in profile view. As for the perspective, all paintings in Nimatnama disregard any aspect of volume and space. Everything is as if compressed, flat, without any hint of depth. But in this painting, just the plate carrying the food is turned by 90 degrees to show its top view, and the rest of the objects are in side view. It is a classic Indian way where the artist did not hesitate to change the viewpoint in the same painting depending on what he wanted to show. After the Sultanate came Babur, the descendant of Timur and Genghis Khan from Central Asia. And thereby began the journey of the Mughals on Indian soil. After wrestling Delhi out of the clutch of the Lodi Sultans, Babur was busy establishing his command on Indian soil. But he began to record his life in the form of an autobiography. It had no painting anyway. But by that time, a revolutionary change took place in Indian context of art. It was paper. With Islam entered paper. Paper manufacturing started too, but how could the royals display the paintings on paper? Nah, not on the walls. The walls were already decorated. Then it could be either standalone folios or part of a manuscript in the form of illustrations of what was being narrated. But that way, the size of the paintings had to be small to fit the space available after accommodating the text. Hence was born miniature paintings. Babur's son Humayun lived a more challenging life. He lost the empire to the Indo-Afghan warrior Sher Shah Suri and had to flee. Though he managed to return and regain his lost dynasty and he admired artists, yet sadly, art did not take off during his lifetime. Just after 6 months of defeating the Afghans, he slipped from the staircase of his library and died. But yes, he had developed a taste for the Persian art. During his days on the run after being driven out by Sher Shah, he lived in the asylum of the Persian ruler Shah Tamas for a year. During that period, he began to enjoy the charm of Persian art. When he came back to India, he brought two Persian artists with him, Mir Syed Ali and Abbas Samad. Even if no painting done by these artists have been possible to locate so far, yet they were supposedly the founders of Mughal art. After the death of Humayun, 14-year-old Akbar sat on the throne. Of course, in the beginning, it was the army commander Bairam Khan who guided the teenage emperor. But soon, Akbar assumed complete power and Bairam Khan had to vacate the Mughal court only to get assassinated on his way to Hajj. Akbar had a real passion for art. He commissioned paintings for the illustrations of Babarnama, the autobiography of his grandfather Babur, and he requested his aunt Gulbadan Begum to write Humayun Nama, the biography of his father, Humayun. Of course, his life was chronicled by his grand vizier, Abul Fazl. Now, all these manuscripts are gold mines of Mughal art. But why do you think that the emperor wanted these books to be written and also painted? Akbar had to overcome the stiff resistance from the clerics who reminded him all the time that painting of human beings was forbidden in Islam. Yes, Akbar wanted his lineage to survive the grind of time. He wanted to remain alive in the mind of people long after he was gone. He wanted to immortalize the glory of himself and his ancestors. Is there anything wrong with that? Don't most of us want to do so? But the trouble was, exactly this is what Islam opposed. But how come the ego of the great Mughal emperor be satisfied? So emerged a large body of Mughal art. Now, let me not put it in a derogatory light entirely, because Emperor Akbar was indeed a man of refined intellect and depth. Beside the glorification of his lineage, he also commissioned the translation of Mahabharata, as well as the Bible in Persian. Akbar was followed by Jahangir and then Shah Jahan. But despite having wonderful taste of art, they wanted mainly their own adventures and achievements to be recorded in the form of paintings, unlike Akbar. At this point too, I must mention that exception exists. Jahangir was not only massaging his own ego by commissioning paintings to depict his own life at court, but also ordered paintings of birds and animals. From his writings, it is evident that he was deeply interested in plants and animals as well as birds. But in the end, larger part of Mughal art originated from the desire to flex ego. Before we talk about the style, we must understand that Mughal art was always a product of the patronage of the emperor. Hence, whatever was painted was actually desired by the court. There was no choice or freedom of the artist in terms of style and content. Ateliers were formed by Akbar where hundreds of artists worked on various projects under a few masters. The rules of painting were so stringent that an artist who left the atelier to seek his fortune in the outer market never painted in Mughal style anymore, because he could employ his freedom then. In fact, it is hardly ever possible to identify an artist from the style in Mughal art. But it is possible to discern during whose reign the painting was done. That is because the style and content were emperor specific, not artist specific. By the way, let me mention here that unlike the Indian context, in Mughal art, the names of artists are generally known to us because such names are written in the manuscript. Now, as for style, there is a striking difference between the Pahari paintings and Mughal. Unlike the native Indian way, the Mughal paintings always depicted exactly what it wanted to convey. It was not covered with layers of symbols. It was direct and factual. As for dimension, an effort was employed to capture the depth. Most paintings depict views observed from an elevation and from a distance, so that the faraway scenes also appear rather convincing. An illusion of depth and volume was created by adding some dark shade at the edges instead of bold border lines around the objects and characters like it was done in Pahari painting. In a nutshell, we can say that Mughal paintings did make an attempt of capturing likeness and volume as well as space, just like the Western way, but definitely Mughal style fell way behind the West. In fact, Jahangir's court was well exposed to Western art due to the visit of the English diplomat Thomas Rowe. Once, Thomas Rowe wrote back to England that only first-rate paintings be sent for the emperor, because he had highly developed taste for art and could differentiate between a bad painting and a good one. Curiously, the Dutch legend Rembrandt too had come across Mughal paintings and was fond of it. He made several paintings claimed to be in Mughal style. You can compare a few and we'll see the subtle difference. Rembrandt naturally could not forego the shortcoming in depth and space due to his Western background. The Mughal siblings of the paintings lack the fineness of exactly those two aspects. Despite having close encounters with the Western paintings, Mughal style did not get much close to realism. Now, the question arises about the influence of Persian art on Mughal art. The dimensional concept employed by Mughal tradition was definitely of Persian root, but not the undivided focus on the ego massaging of the patron. There are paintings of nature or people of less significance in Persian painting. Also, the color schemes appear different in Persian art compared to Mughal art. Mughal paintings appear less adventurous in making the background a dazzling composition of contrasting hues, unlike the Persian style. Of course, the three-quarter face was clearly a Persian import. In the end, do you see the hard reality that the entire body of Mughal art was the product of what the patron wanted, and rules declared the final word. Neither content nor style was the artist's choice. Hence, it was those who mastered the skill of painting in a certain manner kept painting in the same way for generations so that they could earn their living. Creativity was not the driving force, if there was some creativity, the credit would have gone to the patron, because the patron told the artist what to paint all the time and also how to paint. After all, the paintings must suit the taste of the patron, the emperor, isn't so? Therefore, in India, during Mughal period too, art survived because, no, not for unbound creative arts, but because such skill brought money. Well, all that was going to change, and change for good. We are on the verge of a revolution now. The art scene of Indian subcontinent was entering a phase of radical transformation as the Mughals were being deposed of their thrones. The ignominious trading posts on the periphery of the Mughal Empire were about to capture the empire itself. The British was, no, not knocking the door, but they were already in. In my next episode, we shall budge into the modern times of Indian art. Stay tuned.